You're listening to the Old Time Radio Show on 71K News Talk Radio. Now back to Denver's Old Time Radio History Buff, John Dunning.
And it is a great pleasure to have Elliot Lewis, who did just about anything you can do in radio. Was Frankie Rimley on the Phil Harris Alice Faye Show. Directed that series in at least in its last years. We'll talk about that. Starred in many suspense broadcasts, played bit parts in others, directed the show through for a couple of years in the early 50s, during which it did some very interesting things, was responsible in no small part for such notable shows as Broadway Is My Beat, Crime Classics, Pursuit, The Lineup, and I won't even name them all, and is now in Hollywood, or in California, writing a series of mystery novels about a detective named Bennett. I guess it's a detective. I have to, I've got the books on order, and I haven't been able to get them yet. Are you there?
I'm here, John. How are you?
I'm just great. That sounds just like Frankie Rimley on the phone.
Does it?
What kind of a character is Bennett?
Bennett is an ex-cop. He got thrown off the force. And he works, he solves mysteries, but not as successfully as your people, because I haven't gotten nominated.
Well, I'm always a nominee and never a winner, you know that?
You said you had two nominations.
I had two nominations and two losses.
Well, that's two ahead of me.
Bennett's World is the new one, right?
Bennett's World is the new one, yeah. And then ahead of that, there were four Bennetts that have numbers on them. Bennett 1, Bennett 2. It's a series for Pinnacle. Altogether, if I finish all I'm supposed to finish, there will be 12 or 13 books.
When did you start doing these?
The Bennett books?
Yeah.
I started writing them about, I guess, 3 or 4 years ago. I was working with E. Jack Newman on some stuff over at Paramount, television stuff. And I had done a screenplay, teleplay, using the Bennett character. And NBC, I think it was, somebody, one of the networks had optioned it. And while it was sitting there, another piece of material that I had written as a suspense mystery story, as a novel, had been making the rounds of publishers. And we got a note from one of the publishers saying, we like the way he writes, but we're not looking for this. Can he do a series? And the day my agent called me about that, I was having lunch with E. Jack, and I repeated this to him, and he said, why don't you make a novel out of that screenplay?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what started it. And they bought it. The people who liked the idea and wanted the series didn't buy it.
Well,
but Pinnacle did and made the deal, and I've been working on it ever since.
I think probably both of us know how publishers are in that regard.
I'm just beginning, to my horror, to find out. You couldn't find the books, huh?
Well, I can't even find my own books half the time.
I know. I looked for a deadline the other day and couldn't find it. Here in Los Angeles.
Yeah, they publish these things and then they just kind of die on you. And when you try to get them through the bookstores, it takes 6 weeks minimum if you can do that. You know?
Yeah.
So I wanted to read them before you got on, but I don't even have them yet. And I wanted to ask you, what kind of a character is Bennett?
Well, I don't know how to describe it. I recall once reading that a novelist said that after he turned in his book, if somebody told him it was the worst piece of junk they ever read in his life, he would agree with them. And if they said it was the best piece of junk they ever read in their life, he'd agree with them, because at that point he had no idea how it was going or what it was about, or pardon me,
yeah,
if it was successful or how the characters related. Bennett is a Vietnam War veteran who has been, as I say, who resigned from the force before being thrown off of it for something that he didn't do, but had too much honor to tell people what really happened.
Mm-hmm.
His wife can't stand being married to a policeman. She's a nice lady, but very spoiled, and she divorces him. And when we pick him up in book one, which was written 3 or 4 years ago, as I say, he gets an assignment to help the department that he used to be a part of from his ex-commanding officer in the department, a captain of homicide, Rufus Drang, and that becomes the first case. Now, the book that's just out, they asked me then to do a longer book. These numbered books run around 200 pages.
Mm-hmm.
The longer one runs, I think, 310 or something like that. Isn't that about what they run?
That's normally what the...
Yeah, so that's what that one runs. And I decided I would do the case that lost him his wife and got him thrown off the force. So that's what Bennett's World is.
Do you consider yourself now primarily a writer or an actor?
Well, I never thought of myself as an actor. The first thing I ever bought for myself and the first thing I ever started working on was writing. I had always done that. Acting was something that was easy for me to do, radio acting anyway. And so I kind of fell into it and made some money that way.
Huh.
But I'd always thought of myself as a writer and a director. Acting was something separate, and producing was simply a way of controlling all the elements, you know.
As I go back into what I know about your career, and instead of starting at the beginning, going back from now, we look back about 9 years ago, and you were directing and producing a series called The Zero Hour, which was syndicated.
Yeah, radio show.
And I listened to some of the tapes of that show, and, you know, you guys did just about everything you could possibly do. You had top-line talent, good writing, solid stories.
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't it work? In the sense that...
They couldn't sell it.
That's what I mean. Do you have a theory about why radio today will not go on stations anymore?
Yeah, I think there's no national advertiser support. We just finished, as you know, we did... Incidentally, I was listening to your on-the-air thing, and I heard Fletcher giving the closing credits. Was that at Studio One?
Yes.
Because Fletcher was my partner, right-hand, the general assistant in the Sears Radio Theater and Mutual Radio Theater that we just completed. And we ran into the same problems there. We just completed doing 235 original hours on the CBS Radio Network. It was the Sears show. Mutual picked up the second year, and they had to give it up because where stations would be able to sell to national sponsors, for example, KNX here is a CBS station and yet carried the Mutual Radio Theater, including the title Mutual Radio Theater. Locally, George Nikoloff, KNX, was able to sell the time... allotments, local time allotments, to national sponsors. If I can name a few of them, Lufthansa,
sure.
General Motors, Wall Street Journal, were buying local spots on KNX, and yet national sponsors were not supporting the shows. And the same thing was true of Zero Hour. In the case of Zero Hour, however, it started out as a syndicated show. When it moved over to the network, I was no longer with it. I don't remember how many weeks or how many shows we did, but those shows were syndicated, as I say, and you said, we had big stars. We would have 3 or 4 or 5 stars on a show coming in to do 2 or 3 hours work on each half hour. I think one of the reasons it was difficult to sell, aside from national sponsor interest, is that in trying to do the dramatization of a novel into 5 half-hours made it necessary to sell for the station to play all 5 half-hours and to play them in sequence, play them in order.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you really are disturbing a pattern that the station has. You, I gather, are now on a station, the broadcast we're doing right at this moment.
Mm-hmm.
Is this on a station that is largely talk?
Yes.
So once a station is patterned, I think they kind of stay that way and they don't like to make changes. Although KNX here, which is an all-news station, carried Sears Radio Theater and carried Mutual Radio Theater and carries High Brown's show, the
CBS Mystery Theater.
Mystery Theater, yeah. Right. So I don't know. I think it's national sponsor interest from what I can gather from friends who are in the agency business. The national sponsors, I don't know, I guess they just don't believe there's an audience. We found quite the opposite. We found that there was an enormous audience and a great audience of young people who were learning how to listen.
Boy, that's sure true. I'll tell you, you find a whole generation that isn't able to concentrate on these things.
Well, I was talking to a man the other day who's with National Public Radio, who said exactly what you just said. He said all of the research that they have done leads them to believe that the attention span of the modern audience is a very, very short span. An hour show they found won't work at all. They can barely get by with a half hour.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I read some research material which indicated that people who had watched television a great deal of the time didn't know what they were watching. They tried it. No, this is real.
No, I believe it.
They tried experiments where they would take the third scene and put it where the eighth scene was and the sixth scene where the second scene was and so on, and people watching it didn't react at all. They couldn't tell the difference. They weren't following the story.
Right.
They were looking at flickering images.
Hmm.
And radio demands that you pay attention. You must listen. It's very rewarding because once you become involved, there you are. I think, do you agree that probably the largest radio audience would be today would be people who are readers? Read books or magazines, newspapers.
The largest radio audience?
I mean, if you were looking for people who would be most likely to listen to radio drama.
Oh, radio drama.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought you were saying something else when you said the largest radio audience.
No.
Yeah.
No, who would listen to radio drama would be people who were readers.
Sure. But you're talking about 5% of the population there.
Yeah, I know, but 5% of how many million people live in this country? That's a pretty big audience for not very much money.
I know.
Audience that's paying attention.
The
big thing about it, you know.
The trouble that you have, I think, when you start dealing with individual radio stations is that nobody wants to go after 5% of the market.
Yeah.
That's sad. But
and yet they are beginning to support cable, which is a small percentage of the market.
Yeah. It is just 2 minutes after 4 at KNUS in Denver, and you're listening to Old Time Radio, which is brought to you by the Public Service Company, and I'm talking to Elliot Lewis, and we're talking about, we're talking about the Zero Hour right now and why shows like that can't work. I think that you really hit a good, valid point on Zero Hour when you said... when you talked about not wanting to break the format, because even stations where CBS Mystery Theater is running, they always want the option to preempt it in the case of a basketball game or something like that.
Well, we have that also with Sears and with Mutual. Many preemptions. KNX would take, if we were preempted for a ball game on a Monday night, they play it on Saturday, Monday's show. Now, we were structured to be... have a different type of show with a different host each night of the week. Monday we did Western Americana stuff with Lorne Greene. Tuesday we did comedy with Andy Griffith. Wednesday, mysteries with Vincent Price. Thursday, romantic people stories with Cicely Tyson. And Friday, adventure science fiction stuff with first Widmark, then Duff, and then Leonard Nimoy. Now, we thought this was a pretty good pattern, but Nick Law didn't have any trouble when he moved it around. But he didn't have to worry about a continuing story.
Mm-hmm.
However, we couldn't do, because of that, and tune in tomorrow night 4, because we didn't know what they would play tomorrow night.
Yeah.
You know, so it just didn't, it's very hard to break into it. But I think the big thing is the attention span that you were talking about. I really...
Mm-hmm.
I think once once an audience starts to listen to radio drama, they will listen and they will pay attention. It would be very hard to turn off Sorry, Wrong Number once you got hooked. You know?
Oh, listen, I can think of a thousand shows it would be difficult to turn off.
Oh, sure.
Is that series still available to stations who want to air it? And can they write somewhere and get it?
I have no idea.
Or that they're just laying there somewhere collecting dust?
I have no idea. I don't know where the masters are, what happened to them. The zero-hour shows were put together by a man named Jay Kolos, K-H-O-L-O-S, who had an advertising agency here in Los Angeles. And he thought that it was the time for radio, and he put this thing together. All I did was produce and direct it and edit it and, you know, all of that stuff. For him.
We came up with a series of actual syndication masters here in Denver about a week ago. A listener called and was kind enough to say that he had some and would loan them to us. And they still had the Kolos production company sticker on them, but there was nowhere on there that indicated anything about, well, if this show doesn't make it, we'll still keep it available. I don't know. I haven't heard of it in years.
I have no idea. I would imagine if anyone was interested, they could look in an L.A. phone book and see if Kolos or his advertising agency is listed and call and find out. But he was the last person I know of that would have had anything to do with it. As I say, they did some further shows after I left.
What we came up with was 11 shows, and I don't know whether that's all the ones that...
I think that's all I did.
Yeah.
Are they continuing stories?
Oh, yes, they're all there. There are 11 five-chapter shows. I think there's one-chapter show in there, isn't there, Jerry? You haven't seen them yet. But they're all there, I believe.
No, after I left, John, he decided he'd do a show less expensively, and I think he did it for Mutual. A half-hour show using old... I don't remember from what series, mystery-type shows, that he had a staff of three writers rewrite.
Mm-hmm.
And they would do a half-hour show a day that was complete in itself. But they broke for so many commercials that I think one of the writers told me they had like 17 minutes left of drama, while the rest of it was commercial time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very difficult to sustain... getting back to attention span, to sustain audience interest when, as you get to the high spot of the scene, and the scene has only run 3 minutes, you then do 4 minutes of commercial.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's well, easy. That to me ultimately is the answer when somebody comes up and says, do you ever think radio will come back even remotely like it was? It can't under that kind of a system, can it?
No, I wouldn't think so. I think the only way it can come back is if somebody gives it a chance to come back. The problem we had on both Sears and Mutual and Zero Hour is that people seem to have forgotten that things have to be sold. It would be very difficult for you to sell me something I've never heard of and didn't know existed. And once I heard of it and found out it existed, didn't know what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And this was true to some degree of the Zero Hour show, and it was certainly true of both Sears Radio Theater and Mutual Radio Theater. Everybody had good intentions, but they sat in their offices waiting for somebody to call them up and buy the show. And I don't think that's the way you run the railroad.
No.
You got to let people know it's out there. The audience reaction was marvelous. People would pick it up and they'd listen to it, and as I say, mostly young audience.
You talk about expense. You had you talk about talent. Rod Serling was the announcer. The music, Ferranti and Teicher did the theme, and you had stars every week like Howard Duff. Edgar Bergen did one, I remember.
Yeah.
The Astons, Patty Duke Aston and John Aston were in one.
They did the opening show.
Whatever happened to Susan Oliver, one of my favorite actresses? She was a star on one of the shows with John Daner.
I don't know. I haven't seen Susie in a couple of years.
She just dropped out of television.
Well, I think, you know, she was a great flyer, among other things. Piloted her own plane. Is a great glider pilot. She may have gone into something else entirely. I never had the feeling that she was that interested in acting. She's a good actress and a beautiful woman.
Back in the 60s, you could literally not turn on your television without seeing the kind of folks you had on Zero Hour. Niemeyer Persoff, Susan Oliver, who was the other one that that came to my mind? I've spaced it now, but real Dick Crenna, you had him?
Yeah.
Those folks were on all the time.
Right. Johnny Daner.
John Daner. Well, yeah, of course, it seemed like what you did with the Zero Hour was that you were using top-line television talent for the leads, right?
They wanted as much name value as was possible in order to help it fail. But then when we did get the people, they didn't do too much about publicizing.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, you have the sales thing. But, you know, radio is funny. I was glancing through your book about radio. At some of the older shows where they used Hollywood names, and for the most part, the fact that the names were there didn't help them very much. Listening to Patty and John Astin do a radio show, they both are marvelous actors. But when you're listening, if you miss the opening credits, you don't know it's Patty and John Astin.
That's right.
We were talking the other day about a show that Lucille Ball had done in radio, and the point was brought up that in the radio days, who was a bigger star, Lucille Ball or the Lone Ranger? You know, because in radio it really doesn't matter. You hear the voice, and part of the magic of the radio drama is that the audience are going to construct your own hero, your own villain, from the voice, from the lines, from the clues and hints you're given by sound effects and music and everything else.
That's right.
So that it was very nice having all of those names on Zero Hour, and we had names on Sears and on Mutual. But the only purpose for them would be to get space in the print,
mm-hmm.
And for advertising purposes, because once the audience gets into it, if you didn't hear, well, you can't use Duff because the voice is so familiar.
Sure.
But if you use Patty and John again, if you missed the opening credits and you just heard these two marvelous performances, you're just interested in the performances.
Right.
And you have no idea who the people are, and you listen at the end if you're curious, you know.
I think the one that Susan Oliver was in is a good example. I mean, like I say, I really liked her as an actress, but I wouldn't have known her from Eve on the radio. But yet I knew John Daner. I mean, you never mistake
from the radio days.
Sure.
You know, incidentally, I was glancing through your book, and you had a thing about the Hermit's Cave.
Yeah.
Wasn't John the Hermit?
John Daner?
Yeah.
I'd never heard that one.
Bill Conrad was the producer.
Right.
We did a KMPC, and I wrote a script for it called, don't remember what it was called. I wrote the script and I starred in it. And I'm positive that John Daner was a hermit, because I remember sitting in the rehearsal and John was doing some jokes at the piano. He's a funny, funny man. And he was doing a routine, some kind of thing, and that was where it was. And I was going to add, I made a note to myself to ask you that question.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, just since it came up, the book, the way the book was put together, a lot of it was done from the press that came out at the time. I collected something like 7,000 or 8,000 magazine articles on it, and the particular, I forget even the guy's name that I cited as the hermit in that show, but that came from Radio Life. They went out and interviewed the guy, I think, and he mentioned being the hermit. But like many other roles, it may have been done by more than one person.
Oh, sure. Once again, we get to the radio performer. You know, the business of how important the actor is that the next week somebody else comes in, nobody knows the difference.
Yeah. Again, we're talking to Elliot Lewis about the great days. The first time I ever talked to you on the phone, I said the old days, and you said, my gosh, don't call them the old days.
Oh, no.
I'll give you a real stock question. How did you get started?
I was at Los Angeles City College studying almost anything, trying to figure out what it was I wanted to do. And I had done in high school in the East, where I was born and raised, I had done some acting in the school play. And so when I came out here, there was an audition for a radio acting class. And since I had an opening in my schedule, I took the audition. I got into the radio acting class. And a graduate of Los Angeles City College, a man named True Boardman, was then producing and directing and writing at KHJ downtown in Los Angeles at 7th and Bixel up above the Cadillac store, and which was the Don Lee Network out here. And True came back to the school to talk to the radio class and invite them to come down and audition for him for a job in radio. And I wasn't in class that day. And I heard about it. I wasn't cutting. I think I was ill. I heard about it later in the week, and I called him, and he said, well, no, you come down, too. And I went down, and he gave me a job.
Hmm.
And so I started working down there. And I did, got in the serial. I don't remember the name of it. Then they were doing a series of shows out here that... called Calling All Cars,
mm-hmm.
Police Story.
Sure. William N. Robeson did that, didn't he?
Robeson did it, and then Sam Pierce did it. And then, so I did it, because we were working right next door to where I was working on the on this serial that I was on for Young and Rubicam. And that Harry Ackerman was producing and directing. And Ted Bliss produced and directed some of them. And Robeson happened to wander by, and he heard me, and he asked me if I want to work on Calling All Cars, and I got on Calling All Cars. Then the Young and Rubicam people got into national radio at that time with a show called Silver Theater. And since I had been working for them, they asked me to come over and play a part on Silver Theater. So I started working on that show, and that led to other shows. I was living in a rooming house near the university, the college, and in the next room was my music professor, who stopped me at breakfast one day and said, you know, you've been working and you haven't been to class in 2 months, so I think it'd be a nice idea if you've got a withdrawal in case you ever want to go back to college. You'd be able to get in, otherwise you're going to flunk everything because you haven't been there. So I withdrew from City College and I went to work as an actor who was also writing. I was writing for The Whistler, and as I say, that Herman's Cave, and doing things like that. I wrote a couple of spots for a show that Sam Pierce was doing at KHJ for Ukulele Ike. Remember?
Oh, yeah.
Gus Edwards.
Yeah.
And then Benny Rubin had a show of his own down there, and he asked me to work with him on the show. So I was doing a lot of acting and quite a bit of writing, but more and more acting. Then in the war came along, and Tom Lewis, who had been head of the West Coast office of Young and Rubicam, no relation, Tom started up the Armed Forces Radio Service, and he prevailed upon the service to take me out of the Quartermaster Corps, where I had been drafted. Don't ask me why. And come to work for him in charge of what we call denatured commercials. And I did 3.5 years of service inventing new ways to record and re-record radio programs. And my little group of 7 other guys, we're doing 120 radio shows a week.
Wow.
We would take them off the air and take out anything that dated them or was commercial or censorable, reassemble them and ship them.
Hmm.
To, I think we had 496 stations around the world. So when I came back after the war, it was very hard to get started again, and an old friend, Ozzie Nelson, called me and gave me a job on his show as an actor, and I started working again. And
what did you do for him?
I mean, odd parts.
Odd parts?
Yeah. Never did a steady part. My wife was steady on the show, played Clara.
This is Kathy Nelson. I mean, Kathy Lewis.
No, this is Mary Jane.
Oh, Mary Jane.
Yeah. No. Mary Jane and I have been married 23 years. Mm-hmm. Kathy Lewis and I were divorced just after On Stage went off the air, and then she died a couple of years after that.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you said your wife about that time, I figured it must have been her, because we're talking about now, about 1944, 44, something along there?
Yeah. No, Kathy was my wife at the time. My wife now...
Mary Jane Croft.
Yeah, was Clara, and then went into television.
You said on the phone the other day, I think I got the figure, I may have gotten the figure wrong, but you said that you once did 20-some-odd shows in one day?
In 1 week.
1 week.
Yeah. I don't know how it happened. I think it was 20 shows because everything was live, and I was including repeats. I know one Wednesday that I've never forgotten. I was on the. I did six shows, three shows and three repeats. Somehow or other, in one day, I did. Fred Allen was out here. I did the Fred Allen show and the Fred Allen repeat, Dr. Christian and the Dr. Christian repeat, and something else that was all on the same day, and that repeat, a Big Town, I think it was. In a Big Town repeat. So that because of the time differential, you went on the air with the early, with the New York show, 3:30 or 4 o'clock on some of them. And we were still broadcasting at 10 o'clock that night, running back and forth.
Hmm. You never did Frankie Remley was never on Jack Benny.
No, Remley was never on the Benny show. They only talked about it. And that gave... Phil, the idea when he did his own show with Alice, that they'd have Remley do it. There were, as you know, and there was a real Remley, and you could hear him laughing on the Benny show. Had a very infectious laugh, and Jack would always do jokes about what a bum Remley was. He was always stoned, and all of the lousy musician jokes. And so Phil tried it, and he tried it the opening show. As I remember it, was with Remley.
Oh, yes.
And they just didn't like the way it went. At that time, I was doing a show on Sundays over at Mutual with Harry Einstein, the Park Your Carcass show.
Right.
And I would go from there and over to NBC. I don't remember what the other show was. To do something else. At all events, I showed up after the first Harris show to do the other show that I was supposed to be doing that day at NBC. And Phil and Alice and Frankie were talking about the opening show, and I asked how it went, and Phil said, I want to talk to you about it. And we went inside and had a cup of coffee together, and he said, Remley doesn't want to do it, and he just doesn't read it right. It's not funny the way he does it. We were talking about, we're going to try it one more week. Would you give it a try next week? And I said yes, and we did 9 years. It just worked beautifully,
Except right around 1951 or 52, you suddenly became Elliot Lewis on that show.
I think Phil and Remley got into a beef
uh-huh.
about the use of the name.